Well, today we're continuing our study in the book of Ruth, and if you were here maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was supposed to preach, and you showed up, and I was not here. I was Ham was preaching both services instead of me, and I'm going to tell you why, and that is because my friend, Giorgio Hyatt, who is the senior pastor of Redeemer Presbyterian in Winston, texted me on a Friday. All right, this was about 4 weeks ago. I got this text from Giorgio on a Friday, and it said this. He said, I hate to ask you guys this question so late in the week, but is there any way one of you could come up here to preach for me on Sunday? Now, he sent this to me and Matt Guzzi, and if you know Matt Guzzi, who's one of the other pastors at Hope, you'll know that he began sweating immediately, right, because he hates to preach. Giorgio went on to say this: my dad has to have emergency surgery in Hawaii on Monday morning, and none of the Winston-Salem guys are available to cover for me this Sunday. Well, luckily, because we have a plethora of pastors here at Hope, Ham was already prepared to preach at OP, and so I called him and said, hey, can you just preach both sites this Sunday? And he said, sure, no problem. And so I texted Giorgio back, and this is what I said: I've got you covered. Now, what I want us to think about is that idiom. What does that mean, right? Because that gave immediate relief to both Giorgio and Matt Guzzi. They were both like, that's like the best phrase I've ever heard, right? And if you study idioms, I always think idioms are interesting because they're unique to languages, right? Each people group has its own idioms that make certain sense in their language. So it's fun for me sometimes to study idioms. And if you study this idiom, you realize that in English it has two different meanings that kind of overlap with one another. The first, I've got you covered, is a military term, right? It's when you provide cover for one of your cohorts who is putting themselves in harm's way. So if they're running between one foxhole in the next or one building in the next, or if you're flying and you're their wingman, I've got you covered means I'm going to protect you, I'm going to defend you in the area where you can't protect yourself, right? It's similar to the phrase, I've got your back, right? That's what it means. But that's not the only thing it means. The other meaning of I've got you covered means this, that I'm going to cover your shame. Where you've exposed yourself to the potential for shame, I'm going to cover you. And that's what's happening in our passage today. In Ruth chapter 3, verse 7, we read this story. When Boaz had finished eating and drinking and was in good spirits, he went over to lie down at the far end of the grain pile. Ruth approached quietly, uncovered his feet, and lay down. In the middle of the night, something startled the man, and he turned and discovered a woman lying at his feet. "Who are you?" he asked. "I'm your servant Ruth," she said. "Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer." "The Lord bless you, my daughter," he replied. "This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask." See, shame is different than guilt. Guilt feels like this: I have done something wrong. Shame says, I am something wrong, right? Guilt says I've done something wrong. Shame says I am something wrong. And you see this really clearly in the story of the fall of Adam and Eve. In Genesis 3, 7, we read this. Right after they had eaten the forbidden fruit, the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized they were naked, and so they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings for themselves. Then the man and his wife heard the sound of the Lord God as he was walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and they hid from the Lord God among the trees of the garden. But the Lord God called to the man, "Where are you?" And he answered, "I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked, so I hid." Why did Adam hide? He hid because he was ashamed of himself. And shame is a function of the eyes. Shame takes place whenever something that you have depended on fails you publicly. As Dr. Dan Allender and Trimper Longman observe in the quote on the front of your bulletin, shame exposes what I trust in for life. Shame arises when we feel deficient, yes, but far more, we feel deficient and ugly when the God we covertly and at times unconsciously worship lets us down and reveals the foolishness of our idolatrous trust. Shame is not primarily an experience of feeling bad or deficient, as it is the exposure of foolish trust in a God who is not God. And that's why I experience shame anytime I have to admit that I don't know something. See, I have a tendency to trust in my intellect for life. And so shame arises for me anytime that my intellect is publicly exposed as deficient, which is why I hate to say the words, I don't know. In fact, I hate them so often that if Holly asks me something at home that I don't know, I will just sit there quietly and pretend that I did not hear her ask the question. And she then, I mean, it's like, you know, red cape bull at that moment. You know, it's like blood in the water, right? Holly's like, whoop, hang on, silence. And she's zoning in on me, and she's like, she realizes, oh, he doesn't know, right? And she'll smile because we've been married long enough to know that this is super conducive to my humility, right? Like, Holly can really help my sanctification at this point by asking me to clarify, did you hear me? I was just wondering if you knew what time the women's seminar was going to be on Friday night. It could be that simple. Like, I don't know if it's 7 or 6:30. And I'll be like, I don't know. And she'll go, you don't know? And I'll be like, no, I don't know. And in a weird way, even in that, like, I don't know what time the women's seminar is on Friday night. Just admitting that causes me some shame because I'm so dependent on my intellect to validate me. I'm so dependent. It's my functional God. Now, that's even more true when you're like Adam, right, in this case, who decided to depend on the testimony of the serpent that eating the forbidden fruit would make him like God. And when he did, he experienced a monumental failure. And consequently, he felt shame both over the failure itself and instinctively decided to hide, right, from both God and Eve, right? They covered themselves immediately because they were so humiliated by their decision. Well, as our passage begins today, Ruth puts herself in a position where the potential for shame is very high. If you've been with us for the past several weeks, and you'll recall that she is embarking on a scheme that her mother-in-law, Naomi, has come up with in an effort to get her married. And the scheme itself was terrible. It's in Ruth 3, 1 through 5, where we read this. One day, Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, my daughter, should I not try to find a home for you where you will be well provided for? Is not Boaz, with whose servant girls you have been a kinsman of ours? Tonight he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash and perfume yourself and put on your best clothes, then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you're there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying, then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. I will do whatever you say, Ruth said. As we mentioned several times, this is an awful, awful idea because women were not allowed to go down to the threshing floor, right? It was forbidden to them. And so instructing a foreign immigrant female to spy on Israelite men as they threshed wheat and then go down to the threshing floor after dark, perfumed and wearing her hottest outfit to lay at the feet of a man who had been drinking, gently wake him up and, quote, do whatever he tells you to do in a land where everybody did what was right in their own eyes is a disaster, right? That is, talk about putting yourself in the way of shame. That's crazy. Now, Ruth probably was unaware of these restrictions because she'd only been in town for 3 months and she'd only been a believer. She'd only converted to Judaism within the last 6 months on her way into the country with her mother-in-law. And so she bravely but naively took Naomi's advice and put herself in a position where she could easily be shamed. If Boaz had woken up and concluded that Ruth was a gold digger following the instructions of a manipulative mother-in-law, or if one of the other men on the threshing floor had woken up and concluded that Ruth was a thief or a slut, things would have turned out very badly for Ruth. But that's not what happened. Why not? Because Boaz took compassion on her. Verse 10, "The Lord bless you, my daughter," he replied. "This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor." But why is Boaz so compassionate? Why does he interpret Ruth's approach in its best possible light? Well, it turns out that Boaz had a very interesting family history. Boaz is the seventh great-grandson of Judah. And Judah was Jacob's son. And when Judah was near, he was an adult, and Jacob, his father, the founder of Israel, was near his death, he pronounced this prophecy over Judah in Genesis 49:10. "The scepter will not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until he comes, to whom it belongs, and the obedience of the nation is his." Now, you would think that being a descendant of Judah would be something to be very proud of, right? This is the one line in the people of Israel who God himself has promised, "You will rule my people forever." So you'd think, oh man, Boaz being one of Judah's descendants has got to be like top shelf guy. But he was in an interesting line of Judah. He descended from a guy named Perez. And Perez was the illegitimate son that Judah had with his daughter-in-law Tamar when she tricked him into sleeping with her by pretending to be a prostitute. And so this entire line of Judah was ashamed. It was a shameful line that Boaz had come from. In fact, because of the illegitimacy of Perez, this whole family tree of Boaz had not been allowed to be a citizen in Israel, and they hadn't been allowed to enter into the tabernacle area to worship the Lord. Deuteronomy talks about this in Deuteronomy 23:2. It says this, "No one born of a forbidden marriage nor any of his descendants may enter the assembly of the Lord even down to the 10th generation." Now here's what's so interesting. Boaz was the 10th generation from Perez. He was number 10. And so for his entire generation, from Judah to now, his people had never been able to worship in God's presence. Now, to make things even more interesting for Boaz, Boaz's mother was Rahab, and she was a prostitute in Jericho, and the one sole survivor of Jericho, because when Joshua had come and surrounded the cities of Jericho, and, you know, they're going to march around it seven times and the walls are going to come down. I don't know if you remember that song from, like, Vacation Bible School when you were a kid, but they'd sent spies in. They'd sent two spies in. And Rahab had taken them in and hidden them. And as a result, she was the only citizen of Jericho that was allowed to survive its destruction when the people of God came in. And, in fact, she converted to Judaism and she married Boaz's father, Salmon. And Boaz was her son. And so what that means then is Boaz had a very interesting story. We talk about telling our stories. You think about what Boaz's story was. He was, in one sense, royal. He was a descendant of Judah. But in another sense, he was super marginalized his whole life. But because he was the 10th in the line, his son wasn't going to be. If he could get married and if he could have children, he could actually produce one of the first potential kings in Israel, because at the time Israel had no king. And so Boaz knew in a very unique way that he was serving the God whose grace could remove shame, because he had the proclivity, he had the possibility for that to actually happen to him and through him in his lifetime. It's no wonder then that Boaz answered Ruth's original question when she came to his fields and started working in his fields. When she said, "Why are you being so nice to me? Why are you being so generous to me?" He answered it this way in Ruth 2, 10 through 12. "At that time, she bowed down with her face to the ground, and she exclaimed, 'Why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner?' Boaz replied, 'I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband, how you left your father and your mother and your homeland, and you came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you've done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge.'" How you describe your conversion explains a lot about how you experience God. Listen to what Boaz is saying. He's explaining Ruth's conversion as taking refuge under God's wings. What does that metaphor mean exactly? Well, remember, this was an agrarian society. They worked in barley fields, and so they had chickens. And whenever foxes would come into the field, or whenever a fire would go through the field, what happened? Well, chicks would run under their mothers, and their mothers would put their bodies over them and allow the fire to break over them and kill them and survive their so that their offspring could survive. Or the wolves would attack them and the chicks could get away. That's what it means to get under the wings. And Boaz is saying, that's what being in a relationship with God feels like for me. It feels like that I'm under his wings, that he's got me covered. Well, consequently then, it shouldn't surprise us that Boaz mimics that behavior when Ruth comes to him and exposes herself to potential shame. Verse 8, "In the middle of the night, something startled the man, and he turned and discovered a woman lying at his feet. 'Who are you?' he asked. 'I am your servant Ruth,' she said. 'Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer.' 'The Lord bless you, my daughter,' he replied. 'This kindness is greater than that which you showed earlier. You have not run after the younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. All my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of noble character. Although it is true I am near of kin, there is a kinsman redeemer nearer than I." Boaz didn't treat her like a prostitute. He treated her like nobility. He said, "Everyone knows that you are a noble woman." He didn't treat her as needy. He treated her as kind. He says, "Oh, thank you so much for this great honor, this great privilege that you have brought me your need." He was delighted. He treated her not as greedy or as a gold digger or as a thief or as a prostitute or as a pawn of a manipulative mother-in-law. He treated her as a gift from God. The potential fulfillment of the promise made to his family 650 years before. He saw her as one who was graciously offering him, an old man with no prospects, the potential to remove 10 generations of shame from his family name by asking him to marry her so that she could bear him an heir. And so what did he do? Well, he exposed himself to potential shame. Verse 13, "Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to redeem, good, let him redeem. But if he is not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. Lie here until morning." Now, imagine what would have happened had one of the other men on the floor woken up and noticed that Ruth was sleeping under Boaz's garment with him. People would have thought, ah, old chip off the old block, isn't he? Yeah, Perez's kid, no shock there. That family's always been a little bit squirrely. You know, his mom was a prostitute, you know. No surprise. You know, he's all honorable and righteous in public, but, you know, give him a few drinks and get in the dark and, you know, we know. But Boaz wasn't worried about what others would think about him. His only concern was her. Verse 14, so she lay at his feet until morning, but got up before anyone could be recognized. And he said, don't let it be known that a woman came to the threshing floor. He also said, bring me the shawl you're wearing and hold it out. And when she did so, he poured in 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then he went back to town. Now, does that story have the ring of familiarity to it? That a redeemer would want you, would be delighted that you bring him your need, that would want you to take cover from your shame under his wings? It should. Luke, in Ephesians 2:11-12, this is what we read about ourselves. Therefore, remember that you formerly were Gentiles by birth and called uncircumcised by those who call themselves the circumcision, that done by the body, by the hands of men. Remember that at that time you were separate from Christ, excluded from citizenship in Israel, and foreigners to the covenants of promise, without hope and without God in the world. So Paul's saying, hey, we're like Ruth. We're coming into this situation with nothing but our need. And how does Jesus describe his desire for us? Well, he does this in Luke 13:34. He says this, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, like a mother hen, our Boaz Redeemer willingly takes our shame into himself on the cross. And we've got some shame to bring him, right? Whether it's the shame of selling out our integrity to perform at work, or it's the shame of selling out our body in order to get attention on Instagram, or the shame of selling out our family in order to relieve stress in our lives, or the shame of selling ourselves out in order to do behind closed doors that which we know we're going to regret in the morning. We've got plenty of shame to bring him. But why would he want to take it? Well, he tells us in Hebrews 12:2, the author there says this, let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Well, what exactly was the joy set before Jesus? What is the thing that Jesus didn't have in heaven? He already had a perfect relationship with the Father. He already had angels who worshiped him. He already had perfect righteousness. What did he lack when he left heaven? You were the joy set before him. He endured the shame of the cross so that he could deliver you from your shame. That was his purpose in coming. See, that's why he's happy to call you his beloved bride. Ephesians 5:25-27. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any blemish, but holy and blameless. See, and that's what brings us to this table. This is where you come to get covered. This is where you come to depend on the love that will never let you go. This is where you come to invest your heart and your hope into the one who is never going to let you down. because on the night he was betrayed, he took bread and he said, look, this is my body which is broken for you. Take of this, each of you. And in a similar manner, he took the cup and he said, this is the cup of the new covenant in my blood, which is shed for the remission of sins. Jesus exposed himself to public shame so that you could know that he has risen victorious over your shame and has promised to publicly proclaim you to be his beloved in front of the host of heaven at the end of time. And that's why he is safe to hope in. He's safe to trust in. Now, this table does come with a warning, and the warning is this: don't come here if you don't have any needs. This table is for the needy. Remember how Ruth brought Boaz her needs, and instead of shaming her for her needs, he celebrated her for them and said, thank you so much. This is the greatest kindness you could bring me. Jesus isn't coming for the righteous, he said. He's coming for the unrighteous. And so this table is for people who need Jesus to cover their shame. And so that you come here needy, and feed upon him, and delight in the fact that his cleansing blood is sufficient to make you holy and blameless in his sight, not only now, but forevermore.